This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
Cycling to the library this morning, my movements would have been tracked by many CCTV cameras. Britain is one of the most watched societies in the world. But if I'm not doing anything criminal, why should I worry? What counts as surveillance and what, if anything, is wrong with it? Philosophy Bites has been carefully monitoring Tom Sorrell for his views on the topic. Professor Sorrell has received two major European research grants to investigate the ethics of surveillance.
Tom Sorrell, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you very much.
The topic we're going to focus on is surveillance. Could you just say at the beginning what surveillance is?
Well, I think we would consider surveillance to be the observation of people by other people, sometimes using technology.
Observation, I can watch somebody across the street. Am I engaged in an act of surveillance at that point?
Perhaps not. You'd probably be engaged in surveillance if there were specific questions you wanted to answer in the course of your observation, and if you were targeting your observation on a particular person, or maybe a particular set of people, or maybe the occupants of a particular space.
Yeah, it strikes me that surveillance is often systematic. There's a sense that you keep a record, you're trying to answer a question, as you say, find something out. What could be wrong with it?
Well, there could be lots of things wrong with it. One thing that might be wrong with it is the fact, in certain kinds of surveillance, that people don't know they're being observed, and that might be prima facie a violation of their privacy. There may be cases in which they are aware that they're being observed. But even there, certain theorists of privacy and even certain policymakers think there's something wrong with it. So in the case of the UK, where there are many, many CCTV cameras, people think that the existence of so many CCTV cameras makes the population suspect, that the mere presence of CCTV cameras alters the status of the ordinary law-abiding citizenry into people who are potential suspects. And it also makes people who are subject to CCTV think that perhaps they're doing something wrong, that they become inhibited, they might not be able to function as ordinary citizens do, exercise their liberties comfortably, and so on.
You mentioned privacy several times there, and there is a sense that what's wrong with surveillance, if there is anything wrong, is that it's an invasion of privacy.
Yes, that's right. If we consider the views that are held about CCTV cameras, that's not a completely easy view to justify, because very often people know that they're being surveyed by CCTV cameras, there are signs that say so, and they're in public places. So the question is, does one have privacy in a public space? And the answer can be yes, but it's not obvious that it's yes in full generality. It would be yes in relation to certain circumstances.
Personally, I feel quite reassured when there's a CCTV camera in a secluded place. There's the off chance that somebody's going to watch me being mugged if I'm mugged, and they might come and rescue me or at least get the culprit afterwards. Now, that seems quite reasonable surveillance, but the kinds of unreasonable surveillance that people get worked up about is usually when it intrudes somehow. It somehow goes into a place that it shouldn't go into. So how do we decide where the legitimate borderline is?
It's a difficult question in general, but the kinds of starting points for talking about privacy seem to be conventions that people commonly observe. These are conventions that make certain spaces problematic to enter without the permission of other people. And those kinds of places, which are places of justified concealment or justified non-exposure, those might be what we call private spaces. And they might include the home, they might include the zone created by one's naked body, and in a strange way, they might include your mind.
So the home, the body, and the mind can all be kept concealed from other people justifiably. And if somebody goes there when they shouldn't go there, it feels like a violation to the individual when they discover this.
Yes, it not only feels to the individual like a violation, but there are reasons that an individual might not be conscious of. why it's a violation. So even if someone doesn't mind their house being visited, there might be reasons why they ought to mind. For example, that visitors are intent on finding where their money is, or that they might be interested in finding information about them that they wouldn't willingly disclose. Those might be reasons that operate even if they don't feel the reasons.
I can understand the issue about the privacy of the home, the privacy of the naked body, if you're not an exhibitionist. But what do you mean by the privacy of the mind?
Well, the kind of conception of privacy that I want to defend is the conception where the mind is a source of judgment. It's a source of belief. And in order for the mind to be a source of autonomous judgment, people have to have a space in which they can consider their reasons for holding beliefs and even experiment with beliefs that they haven't entirely justified. Their mind has to be free from too much inspection, and that means too much inspection of their speech.
Well, not everybody's got a poker face, and some people are incredibly perceptive, and they might be able to read everybody's body language, so I might know that you're thinking, what an idiot, what a stupid question, as I'm asking this. So in that sense, I might be said to be invading the privacy of your mind.
I don't think my claim is that people who are incredibly perceptive should have a kind of perceptiveness bypass. That isn't within the area of unacceptable violations of privacy. I'm not even sure it is a violation of privacy when it suddenly occurs to someone that folks have a particular character or are thinking of something that they don't mean to express or expose. I think that among the paradigm non-invadable thoughts are thoughts about one's political affiliations, thoughts that one might have about other people that one might express to one's intimates but wouldn't want to express everywhere to everybody else. I think another area that comes up here is simply saying and expressing frankly views that you might not find it easy to express, but that one ought to be able to express, as one says, privately. This is connected with the privacy of the home. In the home, one should be able to say and behave in a fairly unguarded way. There is a kind of reason for having a kind of area that's excluded from public gaze and public criticism for the sake of spontaneity and for the sake of autonomy.
Is what's underlying all this the sense that autonomy is a core value, and that invasions of autonomy in the home, in relation to the body, and in relation to the mind are just examples of a whole range of ways in which our autonomy can be threatened?
That's a good way of summarizing it. It's not true that everything about invading the bodily space can be explained by reference to autonomy, but if one has to answer the question, what in general makes privacy valuable, it may be that you need privacy in order to be an autonomous person.
So we flourish by having spaces in which we can do as we please without the risk of being judged or observed from outside.
I think it's even sub-flourishing, if you see what I mean. Even to be you, you need a space of autonomous reflection. Otherwise, you might become the mouthpiece for the people around you. If you're never able to have this space that's afforded by the private mind, you just become a mouthpiece for an official view or the views of your parents or the views of your friendship group. You need a space in which you're able to put your own stamp on your beliefs, and that means coming up with reasons for them from your own point of view.
The paradigm case of bad surveillance is the Big Brother state, which observes individuals with a view to catching them out.
Yes, that's the paradigm case. It doesn't just observe people with a view to catching them out, say, catching them out in the commission of some minor crime. It's also, in the paradigm case, a matter of trying to show that folks violate a kind of orthodoxy that's imposed from above. That's certainly the message of 1984, that there's a kind of orthodoxy and a kind of thought police that operates to enforce this orthodoxy. And I think it's a similar view that makes the Stasi state so objectionable. It's against that background that I think the emphasis on autonomy, when we're talking about privacy and so on, that emphasis makes sense.
So does that mean there's nothing wrong with surveillance in public places when it's done by a democratic liberal state?
Well, there are a number of people these days who write about privacy and who write about the wrongness of surveillance who think that any surveillance by a state is objectionable on the ground that states themselves are extremely powerful agents against which ordinary individuals need to be defended. That's a view that I dissent from.
Why?
Well, it seems to me that there's a world of difference between the Stasi state and the sort of state that we occupy in the West, in particular in the UK, which has such a profusion of CCTV cameras. The profusion of CCTV cameras is not connected to a Big Brother. There are a lot of CCTV cameras, but there are many different agents who operate these CCTV cameras. So supermarkets operate them, petrol stations operate them, the police also operates them, but ordinary householders operate them. And in order to sustain the analogy with the Stasi state, there has to be some central receiver of all of this information, and it has to be used for sinister purposes. And there are many perfectly innocent purposes that a CCTV camera is used for, like the policing of ordinary public spaces against ordinary kinds of crime.
Yet there is a power relationship inherent in the observer watching someone else without themselves being seen.
I myself don't think that there's always this power relationship, no matter who is being watched and no matter who is watching. It's perfectly possible, for instance, for a husband or a wife who suspects their partner of infidelity themselves to follow their husband or wife to find out whether this is the case, and to do this on the basis that they've been promised fidelity, and to check whether this fidelity is being observed. In that kind of a case, it's not necessarily that one powerful person, by observing the other, is enforcing a power relationship. On the contrary, it may be that one person is trying to check that a relationship of trust, perhaps between equals, is being maintained.
So you've given an example where there definitely is surveillance, and you're saying it's not a power relationship involved. Nevertheless, is it an acceptable kind of surveillance?
I wouldn't say that in general this has to be wrong. It depends on what is being checked for. In a case where there's an agreement between two people about fidelity, one of the things that's expressed by those promises of fidelity is the idea that one's life is pretty much what it purports to be in relation to this person with whom one promises to be intimate. And I think one could, on roughly contractualist grounds, say that the surveillance might be justified, that it's not necessarily objectionable.
One of the commonest ways in which issues of surveillance come up today is in relation to security. And many liberal democratic states are currently expanding surveillance of citizens on the grounds that it will increase security. Some people think that the sacrifice of privacy is too high a price to pay for that.
Yes, I disagree with that line of thought. It seems to me that privacy could be given up for the sake of security. One reason might be that privacy is not so valued by many people. There's a lot of exhibitionism through social media. There's a lot of voyeurism through programs like Big Brother. People who engage on that en masse can't really say that privacy matters so much. So that's one kind of a reason for thinking that the value of privacy can be overridden. But in general, one wants to have good reasons for overriding it. We can talk about two different cases. We can talk about cases where there are general fishing expeditions, where there's no evidence of an imminent threat, there's no evidence even of a definite threat, and where police have hunches about the kinds of people who might be dangerous to society. We can think about those kinds of cases. In those kinds of cases where there are vague suspicions of threats and therefore no clear security threat, the sacrifice of privacy might be relatively unjustified. But in cases where there is evidence of imminence and evidence of a serious attack, it seems to me that privacy is easily trumped by the threat to life. It's just a question of making sure that surveillance isn't too often of the first kind rather than the second kind.
One recent innovation in airport security is the full body scanner, and this is something which has caused a lot of consternation. Is that an invasion of privacy?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because in a research project I've been involved in, we've actually done quite a lot of work on body scanners. There are kinds of body scanners in existence that solve this problem. There are kinds of body scanners that will show to police or to officials at an airport where on the body something that might be concealed is, but they don't show it in such a way that the body is photographed. So what they produce is a stick figure, and the stick figure has indicated on it where something needs to be investigated further, and then there would be a kind of pat-down search or some other kind of search done. But there wouldn't be on these kinds of scanners routine quasi-photographic representations of people, and so many of the objections to them are overcome. There's a bigger issue in the case of body scanners and many other things at airports. This takes us back to the idea that a whole population is being regarded as suspect. Everybody who is at an airport has to go through these things, even though everyone agrees that not everybody is equally suspect. Well, on the one hand, you can say that the whole population is suspect so that the surveillance state is operating. But on the other hand, you can say this very inconvenient way of examining every person is the very paradigm of non-discriminatory investigations of threat. Everybody is treated in the same way, but at least no stereotypes are being used. At least nobody is prejudicially distinguished from everybody else. Everybody is in the same boat.
It's fair to say that there's been a huge increase in interest in questions about surveillance recently. Is that just a matter of the technology evolving, or is there something else going on?
I think it's something to do with the prevalence of human rights approach to many questions of privacy. In the framework that's part of human rights law, the kinds of agents that one has to protect people against are powerful agents, and the paradigm powerful agent is the state. And one of the issues about surveillance, as we've already discovered, is the issue of whether every time there's surveillance by the state, it's particularly sinister, and whether it's sinister just because the agent involved is powerful. I myself think that the human rights approach to things overdoes the connection between wrongness and the exercise of power. It's perfectly possible for quite ordinary-sized individuals who are relatively weak compared to states, it's quite possible for those people to do tremendous wrong, even though they don't register very prominently in a human rights consciousness. A human rights theory tends not to worry about the kinds of incursions of individuals by other individuals. They're almost always concerned with incursions on individuals by states.
So does that mean we need a more subtle approach to surveillance?
I think it means we need to have a more philosophical approach to surveillance. I think that the human rights approach to surveillance, which is well motivated, is probably too blunt a weapon to be used for a lot of privacy issues and a lot of surveillance issues. Instead, we need to use the apparatus of moral philosophy, which is far, far more subtle and also entails many of the correct precepts of human rights.
Tom Sorrell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are now two Philosophy Bites books published by Oxford University Press. Support Philosophy Bites and buy Philosophy Bites and Philosophy Bites Back. For more details, go to www.philosophybites.com.